Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features session audio from the EDUCAUSE 2013 annual meeting. You can find more audio and video by searching for EDUCAUSE on YouTube and iTunes.
It's great to be with you this morning. Good morning. I know what my CIO would be thinking, which is, why the hell did they ask him to speak to people who know about technology? But he's not here, so I'm not going to worry about him today. I'm going to ask for your forbearance for just a moment because I want to contextualize a little bit of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to actually get a little personal, if you don't mind. So this is the house where I was born in New Brunswick, Canada. And anybody here from Maine? If you know Maine, you know that the only thing you can grow in Maine are potatoes and blueberries. This was worse. This was a hardscrabble little farming village where I was born, and I have four older siblings. This is the kind of place where people went maybe to eighth grade, which is what my parents did. And that's a picture I just recently found of my grandfather with my oldest sister. And this is not from the 1800s, though it looks like it could be. It's actually from the 1940s. When I was born, decided they would immigrate. So we came to the United States. We were able to get, at that time, you get a passport. You could green cards, right at the time. I never got cuter than this, by the way, as you probably figured out already. And someone said, did you get run over by a car? Those are not tire treads. That's a sort of stamp. I know, not many people can pull off this outfit, which is double plaid, right? And this was when we moved to Waltham, Massachusetts, the south side of Waltham. And it's the same sort of street where every immigrant group before us moved, and it's where every immigrant group after us moved. I've done this version of this talk, and I have no gracious way to do the next slide without sounding like I'm doing a little parental bragging, so I'll say I'm doing a little parental bragging. This is me with my father-in-law, who's also a stonemason, as was my father. His first time he had ever traveled abroad, we're at Oxford, where my daughter on the left is a Rhodes Scholar, and this is in front of Rhodes House, that's the immodest part. And that's my other daughter, who just started school at Stanford. And the reason I'm putting this slide up here is that when I was thinking about this and trying to connect the dots between that farmhouse in rural Canada and where my daughters are today in the life, the thing that connects the dots was high quality, affordable education, right? That was the dream. I was the first in my family to go to college. I went to a state institution, a state college, and then later a public university, and then made opportunities available to them. How many of you are also first-generation college goers? I bet you there's a lot in the room, a lot of hands going up. So we lived, as it turns out, in our time, the American dream. But that story today is actually more the Danish dream. Because the kind of social mobility I'm talking about happens more often now and more easily in Denmark than it does in the United States. In fact, it happens not only in Denmark, but it happens in Norway. I don't know why Norway is up there. I gave it away. I was going to ask you, shout out your flags if you know them. Where is this? Finland. Obviously Canada, ironically, the place we left for opportunity. Now you get to Sweden. And now the one that's maybe most galling at all to Americans who believe that we are still the place of the greatest opportunity is the next one. Which is, France, the bastion of, rigid class and lack of social mobility. Actually, it's greater social mobility than we enjoy in the United States today. This is yet another kind of take on that, which is about intergenerational movement and the difficulty of moving. Someone told me, so I was giving this talk, and I used a slide, and they said, no, that's not right. And I said, look, I got it off the internet, so the internet doesn't lie. It must be right. But I think the point here is what we know today is that if you are born in the lowest quintile of income in America, there is a 60% chance you will live your life and die in poverty. Think about that. In this land of opportunity, that's our myth, that's our central cultural myth. If you're born in the top of the bottom 20% of income, you will live your life and die. And if you, by the way, the flip is also true. If you're born in the top quintile, you will live your life and die in relative privilege and wealth. And the thing that makes the difference, what the Pew's latest research shows, is that a college degree gives you a 3 times better chance of moving out of that bottom quintile. That's what we're in danger of losing, I think, in this country, as we see more and more students marginalized and unable to access this incredible transforming force that you all are part of and that's increasingly out of the reach of students. So we took on, at my institution, this question of how can we respond? How can we rethink our business models? Because the fundamental issue here is one of sustainability. Whether you love higher education today as it is and has been, or whether you're one of its critics, one of the messages of President Obama's most recent higher ed speech is that the model is broken. People do not have access to the kinds of funding they once did, whether it's in the loss of state funding, the loss of equity in their homes, right? All of these ways in which higher ed's been gutted. And we now see incredible levels of borrowing with over $1 trillion of student debt out there. That's more than all credit card debt put together. And lots of worries about that. So we took it upon ourselves to start thinking, how can we change things? How can we sort of reinvent the models? And I'm going to talk about a specific model that some of you have heard about in just a few minutes. So we asked three questions. I'm going to go through these in some detail. The first one is, which higher education do you want to fix? The second one is, how will you use technology to do so? So a question germane to you all. And then lastly, how can disaggregation help this along? And these are three critical questions. And the first one is one that is a source of frustration for me, because I think a lot of the debates we have in higher education today get muddied because we're not clear about what problem we're trying to fix or what higher ed we're talking about. What do I mean by what higher ed? Well, there are many higher educations in the United States. There's a higher education that is denominational, tied to religious backgrounds and connections. There is a research higher education, and people are really happy with that one. We're not asking that there be less of that in this country. There is a military higher ed. There is traditional higher ed, the coming-of-age experience of 18-year-olds on residential campuses. This is a very expensive one, hard to sustain. There is entertainment higher ed. Some of you are at institutions where you participate in a form of higher ed that is a multi-billion-dollar industry and has lots of critics today. And then the higher ed that we were really interested in was workforce development and adults. So if I look at that bottom left corner, only about 15% of college students today fit that profile. Four-year, first time living on a campus, having this amazing coming-of-age experience. And when you think about what they buy, if you'll give, let me use that expression for a moment, students are buying two things, and they don't ask a lot of questions about the first, which is the academic program. I would argue if you go on most tours of most of the campuses here, you won't hear a lot of questions about that, not because they don't care. It's actually an act of faith. They take for granted that they're going to get a pretty good education. The thing that they ask about are, what are my clubs and opportunities, study abroad, who will I live with, when will I get a single, what sports, what support services do you have? I have a learning disability, what will be in place for me there? And all of that comes together around coming of age, about reinventing themselves. We, 15 years ago, did a three-year undergraduate degree program, which we still offer. And we were frustrated for a long time because we couldn't get a lot of interest in that program, even though it seemed like a no-brainer. It saves 25% off the cost of a four-year degree. And we did this with FIPSI funding, and it's really well-designed. It's an early competency-based program. And it occurred to me one day that if you think about it, if you think about what people buy from us, we thought parents would be really excited about that 25% savings, and they were. But students, 18-year-olds, who had been coveting a college experience, been working for it, had been looking at depictions of it in TV and film that looked great, can't wait to get there, what were we saying to them? Oh, by the way, we'll give you 25% less of this thing that you covet more than anything right now. And they weren't coming. So when we recently repositioned our degree in three programs to say, 4 years on campus, come out with a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, all of a sudden we've seen this upswell in numbers. So Clay Christensen, who very much informs a lot of my thinking, sits on my board as an old friend, he would say, and I think a part of his research that is not read enough is his jobs to be done research, which is that institutions get into a strategic mess when they don't understand what people are buying from you, and you think you're selling X and they're buying Y. We don't even like that expression. We don't like the language of buying. But people buy solutions to problems when they make these sacrifices to come to our institutions. So one of the things we try to get very, very sharply focused on is what are people buying from us when they come to any one of our programs? And in our institution, we have three basic business units or academic units. We have the undergraduate college, 3,000 students, coming of age, classic. It looks like, you know, New England residential education as it's been depicted forever. We have now the third or fourth largest not-for-profit online program in the country with 30,000 students. If the first group is buying education and coming of age, the online student, 30 years old, juggling family and work, they're not coming. They've got more coming of age than they can deal with. Thank you very much. Right? They're driven by four C's. And their four C's are cost. Can I get this degree that I've been needing for a long time at a price that I can afford? The second one is completion. How fast can you get me there? Because the thing they need more than anything is a credential. That's what they're buying. They're buying a credential. In fact, if you listen in on those admissions calls for online programs, they're not necessarily very inspiring much of the time. And the other one is convenience. I said four C's, right? Because what people are saying is, I'm working, I need better work, I need more stable work, I have a promotion possibility, but I don't have a degree. I don't really want to spend a lot of time thinking about education. I need a credential, I need it as fast as I can. Now, our job is to make sure they have a good education. So I'm not saying you should ignore that fact. What I'm saying is understand what they're doing and then build your business models to deliver on that. I'll give you one example where we borrowed from Phoenix University. The for-profits are much maligned. They are so much better than most of our industry at customer service, a phrase that most of us can't even use on our campuses. Imagine if you walked into the next faculty senate meeting and said, on the agenda, I would like to put customer service. And then someone said to me, CIO stands for, what was it? Career is over. I never heard that before. but that would be one way to get there quicker. So with Phoenix, for example, we know that our practice was that if you said, I'm interested in your evening programs or online program, typically students have credits from two or three institutions, we would say, okay, here's the deal. We want to give you transfer credits wherever we can. We want to speed your time to completion. Get us those transcripts. This is how you do it. Make sure they're mailed to this place, et cetera. And then we'd wait. And that busy adult, and it's 4:30 because it's after work, is now saying, oh, but I can't do that now because I have to get my kids to soccer practice. I'll do it tomorrow. And then tomorrow comes, and then where do I call again? I have to send a check, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these difficulties mount. And if you sit here thinking, well, wow, that can't be a very serious student, I would argue that you fundamentally don't understand the plight of most working adults. They have 100 reasons for not enrolling and 200 reasons for dropping out when things get tough. This is a fragile marketplace. These are people who have lots of pressures on their lives by and large. So these barriers actually do make a difference. So we do what Phoenix does. We say, click here, give us permission. We'll track down your transcripts. We'll pay the $10 fees. We'll be able to turn around your transfer credit evaluations in 2 to 3 days, right, as soon as we get them in. Those are the kinds of business processes that you start thinking really hard about when you get really focused on who you're serving. And if you've built your adult business around the policies of your traditional students, where the financial aid discussion is often 2 years, you are way out of alignment. And a lot of institutions' attempts to do forays into online learning and other things are thwarted because they're trying to make use of policies that were never invented for the business model. They undermine the business model. I would also argue, by the way, that SIS systems do this as well. And I'll say a little bit more about that later. Our third program, College for America, the modestly named College for America, is our competency-based program. And that program is designed yet for another problem. In this case, it's an on-ramp. That program is geared for the bottom 10% of wage earners in very large organizations who are typically not making family-sustaining wages. So call center workers making $22,000 a year, package handlers in an express mail facility in Memphis, you know, working the graveyard shift. Guy working at ConAgra food plant, our first graduate, on the graveyard shift doing sanitation, where they make Slim Jims. Three shifts a day, by the way. Who knew there was such a demand for Slim Jims? But the problem we're trying to solve there is super low cost, in our case, $1,250 for every 6 months, super low cost, and competency-based. So taking advantage of what people already know and getting them degrees quicker. And here what we're trying to do is give them basic upskilling so they get more stable work. That's the educational goal for a lot of America. In a world where manufacturing is going and where we're seeing huge increases in productivity with much smaller workforces, part of the demand is, I need more stable work. I need better work eventually. I want opportunity. So we think about it as an on-ramp. And our customer there as well is the employer. So we deal with large-scale employers. And what they're saying to us is, we can't get people with the basic skills anymore. Here's the deal. I was going to say this later, but I'll do it now. You should do this with me, because this is the exercise when I go and I sort of present before HR people or CEOs. Raise your hand if you have somebody working for you today who has a 4-year college degree from a reputable college, whatever, however you define that, 4-year college degree, who doesn't write very well. Yeah, exactly. Raise your hand if you have somebody with a 4-year college degree from a good school who has trouble navigating spreadsheets and budgets and basic quantitative reasoning, right? All the hands go up again. 40 years ago, a college degree was a signal to the labor market that you knew stuff, right? Somebody with a college degree, you were reasonably expected, like, oh, this is somebody who can think critically, can answer problems, who can write pretty well, who's presentable. The clincher question is, do you have anybody who recently graduated from college you'd never put in front of a room of customers? Every hand goes up in the room. Everyone knows the guy, too, by the way, like, oh, you know Bob at the corner. So now what we're trying to do with this new program into the labor market is we're saying, we're going to not give you courses and credit hours. We're going to give you 120 competencies. We're going to be crystal clear about the claims we make for our graduates. We're going to define those with rubrics. We're going to share those with you. And then we're going to stand behind those claims with strong assessment, so strong that we'll let you look at student portfolios so you can look at the assessments we used with those rubrics we used and decide for yourself. Employers love this. They love this. So who are you serving? What are they buying from you? Second question is around technology. So we have a long, illustrious history of dealing with technology that goes all the way back to the overhead projector when we took it from the bowling alley to the classroom. It's not a very good slide, but that's what that is. And when I think about technology, I think about it in sort of three boxes, if you will. And this is, again, now this is where I feel, if there's any anxiety about presenting to you all, this is where I really get into, because you know this way better than I do. But here's my simplistic presidential take on this. One is that there's technology that I bring into my institution so that I can keep doing what I've always done, but do it better. And here I think we have a long, illustrious history, right? We've brought in all kinds of innovative new work into the classroom, into the learning experience, and we do what we've always done, but we do it a lot better. And by the way, we've added a lot of cost in doing so. And if the problem we now have in America from a policy perspective is sustainability, that work, so important and so rewarding, is actually exacerbating our problem, not making it better. The second use, these are guys at a kiosk in an airport, the second use of technology has to do with doing the same thing we always did, but pulling cost out. And usually people, by the way. So when you leave here, those of you who are flying and you walk into an airport and slide your card at a kiosk, you're doing all the same things. Workflows are essentially the same. Your name's being checked against a passenger manifest, against a TSA database. You're registering how many bags. It's producing bag tags that are scannable. It's going to produce a boarding pass. And you're not going to deal with the human till you walk up to the counter and hand your bag over and show your license. So they've reduced a bunch of costs with the use of technology. And a lot of people think that the largely or somewhat jobless recovery we are in today has a lot to do with this use of technology. That we've seen these incredible returns of productivity with far fewer people. Take, for example, this summer, I thought it was symbolic that in the same week that Kodak filed for bankruptcy, Kodak with 146,000 employees at its height, that same week Instagram was sold to Facebook for $1.5 billion. How many people worked at Facebook at the time of that sale? I mean, at Instagram at the time of that sale? 13. 13 people, right? So this is one form. So if you think about higher education, how much of this have we done? Well, we certainly haven't done it in the core of what we do, which is the delivery of education. But we've done a lot of this ostensibly in the back office, under the hood, right, systems. I had this discussion with one of your colleagues this morning who said, when I said, it's not clear to me from where I sit that this has saved a lot of money. I'm not sure that as a not-for-profit industry, now I'm talking to those from the not-for-profit sector, that we actually use technology in this way to take bodies out, to take personnel out. And maybe we do things better, so I think it kind of lapses back into the first box. But I don't think we see a huge amount of it. She disagreed with me, and she knows her work better than I do, so I'm going to side with her and say, there's a better story here than the one I can tell. So let's assume that we've been doing some pretty good work on that score. And then the last is, this is Amazon's warehouse, the last is when you use technology not to do what you've always done before, but better, not to do what you've always done before, but at lower cost, but to do things quite, quite differently. And this is the place where higher ed's really not very good. This is hard for us. Because what ends up happening here is that you take sort of a focus on the problem you want to solve, and you take this sort of new technology, harness technology in these various ways, and then you ally it with the last piece, which is unbundling. Excuse me, I'm going to have a Marco Rubio moment and get some water. If I do this right, I should be ducking off camera for a moment. So in the last case, let me talk about disaggregation or unbundling, as people often say. So if you think about it, institutions have unbundled lots of things that were not core to us. So we say, you know, we're not in the business of food service. Let's hire Sodexo. They'll do our dining services. And they may do our maintenance as well. And we're not going to build a big internal marketing team. Let's hire marketers because that's what they're really good at. And there are all sorts of things. You do this in your world all the time. But the core of what universities and colleges have always done, which is delivering education, has been vertically integrated. If you think about that, then academic program has its genesis with faculty. They think about the program they want to create. They create the courses. They do the syllabi. They curate the learning content, whether it's choosing textbooks or pulling things together. They move it through governance. They shepherd it along. They show up at open houses and persuade students they should enroll. They deliver the program once it's up and running. They intervene when students run into sort of trouble and need those sort of learning interventions. They do the assessments, and we hope that they revise the course once in a while. And really, the core of the academia has been vertically integrated in the form of the faculty. That's being blown up today, so that now we routinely see courses being created, programs being created with subject matter experts and instructional design teams, and you know this. And the subject matter expert, that faculty member, may never teach the course. We've unbundled. And in terms of delivering, certainly there are lots of uses of instructors. We make extensive use of instructors in all three of what we do. Well, not two of the areas of what we do, but we might look elsewhere. So in our College for America, there is no instructional faculty. We rely on peer-to-peer learning. We rely on the strength of the curated learning materials. We do lots of other things. Folks who are really interested in adaptive learning, personalized learning, they're putting a lot of attention on the same. Maybe not the instructor all the time. Western Governors has unbundled in this way, right? So there's faculty support if you run into trouble, but there's no instructor for the course. So lots of ways. And you get more radical ed tech people who push this model out even further. Tutorial services. On our online program with 30,000 students, we use smart thinking. There are other people who do this. So at the heart of unbundling in mature industries, and we're about as mature an industry as you can get, is the notion that for some pieces, there are other people who do it better than you, or who can do it more efficiently. This is what's happening now in the unbundling within higher ed, and then assessment teams who separate out from the delivery, and then you take the same piece, you may revise that course with another subject matter expert, maybe not the same one, bring in a lot of sort of data analytics. You look really hard at that. We're doing this work differently, and there are lots of new providers for each of these. So we see this burgeoning industry, people who are not part of our landscape in the core of what we do, who are stepping in and doing parts of this for us. And the most aggressive in the ed tech sector, and then the second most aggressive in the for-profit sector, are actually taking these pieces and saying, let's think differently about how we put them together. And that, at the end of the day, gets you to the real key of this, which is when you take these three things, at the intersection is where you can start to rethink your business models, where you can actually rethink delivery models. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about how you pull that off in a traditional institution, because it's very hard to do. And I think there's a playbook, and it's one we have used about separation, about giving people permission to break rules, about giving them freedom from systems, about changing culture. All of those things happen. But this is fundamental, I think, how we think about new programming and new innovative delivery models. And that's the challenge I think we're all going to be faced with as we try to drive down cost and yet serve more people. And in our case, it led to the creation of this program called College for America. Now, we launched this program back in January. If you don't know, I'll just give you a very, very brief background. And it's the first competency-based program of its kind to be approved by the Department of Education. It happened back in April. And what the department did under the direct assessment provisions of Title IV, it said, for the first time, we will give federal financial aid to a degree program untethered to the credit hour. Because if you think about the credit hour is really good at a couple things. I mean, it's like the Higgs-Boson particle of higher ed. Right? If the Higgs-Boson particle holds the universe together, well, the credit hour is designed to figure out how to pay pensions to retired faculty members. And yet it has permeated higher ed in ways it was never intended to do. It's how we unitize knowledge. It's the building block of programs. It's the milestones we use to measure student progress. It's how we assign faculty workload. It's how we schedule our classrooms. It defines our physical resources. It is, most importantly, the basis for giving out $153 billion of federal financial aid every year. That's the oxygen that keeps us all here. If that goes away, higher ed collapses, right? And it's the credit hour that drives that as well. And the credit hour is very good at telling you how long someone sat. but it's not that great at telling you what they learned. And when I go back to that crisis of confidence that our society now has in what we do, that so many of our institutions are producing people who can't write, who can't do math, who aren't presentable. This is, I think, critical that we start to change that and think differently about it. So we set out, inspired in large measure, I know this is a pedestrian way to come up with an inspirational idea, but a 60 Minutes interview with Muhammad Yunus, the founder of the Grameen Bank. Muhammad Yunus was asked the question. They said, do you know the Grameen Bank? It's kind of founder of microcredit in Bangladesh. And they said, how did you come up with this idea? And he said, well, I thought a lot about what banks do, and I thought, I'll just do the opposite. They lend to men, I'll lend to women. They make big loans, I'll make little loans. They make come to the bank, I'll go to the village. They require collateral, I'll require none. On and on and on and on. So we thought, no, what if you ask that question about what we do, our endeavor? And if you start with the first one, which I said, the thing that becomes fixed here is the learning, never negotiable. All of a sudden, grade inflation starts to go away. No one gets passed through with a C in college composition, right? And I'll talk about how we sort of do that. We dig deeper into this. And time becomes a variable, because why should we care? If someone can demonstrate mastery of a competency, why would we make them sit in a classroom for 16 more weeks? So our first graduate went from 0 credits to an associate's degree in under 100 days. You'll see him in a moment on screen. And we have a lot of students who've earned their associate's degree in under 9 months. So time becomes the variable. This sounds like faculty bashing, and it is not intended to be, and I don't think it is. I think I can make a pretty persuasive case that most of academia is built in some ways on the sort of orientation of faculty. In some ways, because of where academia started, and we just sort of carry that forward. It's not really student-centered. Also, I said if we were really student-centered, we'd have any classes before 10 a.m., and we'd be teaching late into the night, for example, among other things. Expert teaching model, what if we went to a mentor model? What if we know a lot about how powerful it is to work with somebody, a mentor or a peer. Peer learning is incredibly powerful, so let's play with that. Let's drive cost out. Open education resources, no textbooks. Let's drive our per-student technology cost down to $12 per student, and on and on and on. Transcripts. Think about, from an employer perspective, when you get a transcript and you see that somebody has a C in sociology, what you really know is that they did better than somebody with a C than a D, right? That's all it tells you. It's relative to everybody else, and you don't know how they did, and you really don't know what they know. You can infer some things. So let's talk about proof of learning. Let's make claims that are very, very clear. And then if you're not doing credit hours, you don't have to think about 16-week chunks. And when you're dealing with the learners we were targeting, highly unconfident learners, records of academic failure, little victories in the beginning help a lot. We did a design study with the Business Innovation Factory out of Providence, Rhode Island, when we were designing the program. And one of the competencies early on was a mastering the paragraph. And we had a student who finished it, and she wrote back to her advisor and said, I never thought I could write. I'm a writer. And I'm thinking, honey, you're not a writer. You got a paragraph done. But for the first time in her life, she thought she was a writer. And the psychology of this for an adult learner and the confidence that you start to build on. And look, that's not college-level work yet, but that's not the end point for her. She has to work her way up to a full mastery of competency as defined at college level for an associate's degree. And that's where we got her to. So very powerful stuff. And the last one is learners come to the institution. I think we're under the fallacy in many instances that adult learners want to come to our campuses, right? Because we love our campuses. But I think our campuses are pretty intimidating places for the people we work with. A lot of people don't look like them. We use acronyms that don't, we use too many acronyms for myself. Acronyms they don't understand, bureaucratic processes that aren't very friendly. We're not operating at the hours that make sense for them. If you're the guy working that midnight shift at ConAgra, when do you go to school? And we thought that there is a lot of social capital in the workplace. So we have a big focus on the employment in the workplace. We got really focused on work. And there are lots of higher eds, right? So there is a higher ed that has to do with creating young adults. That's not this higher ed. This is how do I get people in better jobs higher ed. So we got really focused. We brought in workforce labor specialists using tools that I find sort of amazing still, maybe not to you. But, these guys don't look at labor department statistics of 2 years ago anymore. They're using real-time tools like Burning Glass to look at LinkedIn and Monster. They're doing real-time job analyses. They're pulling from that real-time competencies. Amazing stuff. And really working closely with employers. So we're working with three major healthcare systems in the country right now, in Louisiana, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. Partners Health, which is the single largest employer in Massachusetts, for example, Ochsner in Louisiana, which is the single largest healthcare system. 80% of your interactions with the healthcare system will be hourly workers and non-clinical. These are where these companies have the highest turnover, hardest time finding the right skills, and the lowest patient satisfaction ratings. So we're working on a version of our program to be based on non-clinical healthcare, right, with customer service competencies and other things built in. Our competencies, we make 120. This is not a sales pitch. I just want to give you a sense of this program because sometimes people just want to say, how does this work? 120 competencies for the associate's degree in three broad areas. Foundation skills, these basic upskilling I'm talking about. I'm still haunted by a conversation with Mayor A.C. Wharton of Memphis, Tennessee, who is one of our partners. The city of Memphis is a College for America partner. And he was talking about how he had worked hard to get a brewing company to come to Memphis with 500 new low to medium skill jobs. Good paying jobs, not great paying, good paying jobs, right? Entry point jobs for people. They had 22,000 people show up for these jobs at job fairs, et cetera. 500 jobs, 22,000 people show up. They could only fill 150 out of that pool. That's the level of skills we're talking about. Ochsner tells us that in some of the places where they have hospitals in Louisiana, 50% literacy rates. Now, we can't deal with that level. How low can you go question we ask? But think about what that says. So, foundational skills. Second one, personal social skills, soft skills, as some people call them. So, this is working in teams, giving and taking instruction, ethical questions. And sometimes I think competency-based education is sort of dismissed as vocational. Students in this cluster are reading Michael Sandel at Harvard on Is Torture Ever Justified? And they're having those debates. They're looking at questions of ethics in the business setting. In one case, they are asked to read a series of essays on theories of art curation, and then to curate a virtual art show, and then write the piece that explains why they made the choices they made, and base that on theory and what they rejected and why. Anyone looking at that objectively would say, that's college-level work. That's higher-level critical thinking skills. That's not simply vocational. And then the last one is the closest thing we do to a major, which is our business tools, business essentials. What do we mean by competency? Everything is a can-do statement. Everything is measurable, observable and measurable behavior. These are some of the examples I'm talking about. Can distinguish fact from opinion, can convey information by creating charts and graphs. That's over in the business tools piece. Can support interpretations and analysis of literary texts because it's an associate's degree. Our accreditor said, you've got to have general education here. Where's your literature? Where's your art? So we build that in. Employers say, we love that ability to look at various articles, make decisions, explain what you're doing. So later on, that gets paralleled in a different kind of competency task. So all competencies are demonstrated by completing projects. And in one project, students are asked to, the hypothetical, the simulation, if you will, is they've been hired into a small company, they replace somebody who's just fired in the middle of a project. They've got three vendor proposals. We provide all of this, so all these materials are there for them. Three vendor proposals in which they're asked to answer a series of questions from their boss and then to make a recommendation on which vendor they should go with. They have to do this in a spreadsheet, but the spreadsheet was half completed by their predecessor and we give them a tip. We're not sure the person knew what they was doing. There may be mistakes. So they have to go in, fix the spreadsheet, right? They're demonstrating. It feels very real world to them. They complete that work. They have to do no more than 3 or 4 page memo. They pull tables and graphs out of the spreadsheet into that, and then they tape themselves giving a 3-minute presentation to the management team ending with their recommendation. That's pretty sophisticated stuff. Multiple competencies, each one defined by rubrics, all of those assessed by a faculty member trained in the discipline. And we train our faculty in the use of rubrics, and they get really fast and good at it. We shoot for a 48-hour turnaround time on these projects. The assessments typically come back in about 30 hours. So really, really fast. Adults say that's very important to them, that they get that kind of immediacy. And the faculty give them great feedback and help. We built all this on Salesforce, and this is a couple of screenshots. Yes, this is from Welcome Back, Cotter. We worked really hard on the interface and got a lot of student bottom-up design Brian Pell's here, our chief technology guy. He did amazing. His team did an amazing job. And this just went live a couple of weeks ago. But here's, you know, typically what you see, progress across the top. They see the competencies that have to be mastered, their overviews, project resources, the curated learning materials, the rubric. It should never be a guessing game for a student to know what they'll be evaluated on, so it's, they know what success looks like. And one of the things that they've told us is really important to them is that they know who else in their company is enrolled, who else is working on these competencies, who else is finished. And we're really sort of impressed with the degree to which the peer-to-peer, almost organic sort of support has sprung up in these workplaces. We actually had Undersecretary Cantor visit with a group of our students. I could tell she was sort of a little concerned that there wasn't an instructional faculty member when someone's working on a project like this. And she said, "Do you miss not having a faculty member?" And they said, "Well, yeah, yes, it'd be nice." But it was kind of a, it's like someone said, "Hey, would you like to have leather interior instead of fabric on your car seats?" "Yeah, it'd be nice, but no, it's okay. I mean, it works for me." And then she said, "But don't you feel abandoned?" And then what was the interesting part of the answer was this. Like, "Oh my God, no, when I was struggling with math, remember, Julie, when I turned to you and you had done that competency before and you said, no, if you turn the fraction this way," and they had all these examples of how they were supporting each other in this very powerful way. Really amazing stuff. So I want to give you a sample of sort of who we impact as my time dwindles down. This is our recent graduates, excuse me. They're going to cue this up for me. So this is just 2 minutes, but it'll give you a little bit of a feel for the student experience of this program. It's not a sales pitch. Do you want to run this?
Hi, I'm Zachary Sherman, and I'm the first graduate from College for America. I still don't know if it's hit me yet.
It's exciting. I finally finished my college degree after 25 years of being out of school.
It's my graduation night. I'm graduating from college, age 49. My parents are very excited.
I work like 3 jobs at a time, so I'm really like going and being in a classroom for 4 to 5 hours was just too much for me on top of everything else, whereas I could be doing this program and cooking dinner at the same time.
I built a lot of confidence in the program, and there was a lot of positive feedback as well. It pushes you when you have the positive feedback.
I give a lot of the credit to my family for pushing me, encouraging me, telling me they were proud of me all the time, and I really wanted to be a good role model to them too, and personally, I wanted to do it for me too.
Wow! Holy smokes! This is amazing. Knowledge and skills and abilities that are needed within the workplace, it's an absolutely amazing concept.
I was a foster kid, so I don't really have, like, I didn't have family to live with, so I had to support myself. So I had to work, and I always said that I'd go to school, but I never really had the time. And I decided that I'd start going so I could be a better person.
Without sounding conceited, I'm really proud of myself. I'm glad, being one of the older ones, that I was one of the ones able to complete.
You think this is going to change your life?
I think it already has.
College for America makes learning so hands-on and exciting. You don't have to wait for a class and have somebody else finish and wait for your grades. You can go and go and go until you finish. This is like revolutionary. I think this is going to be the way education is in the future.
So those are the students, and the thing I want to say about that is sometimes people who don't like the work we're doing in this area, some of the incumbent models and folks who are very invested in the education that many of us had, will say, you're going to ruin that. I was like, these people aren't going to my campus, right? This goes back to that first of the 3 questions. What problem are you trying to solve? And for these people, this program works better than me trying to take an old model, an incumbent model, and trying to make it work in their world. And this is what we do with this. And I think part of what is really exciting about outcomes-based approaches to education or competency bases, when we get really crystal clear about the claims we make for learning and we get really rock solid about the assessments, we open up a world of innovation, right? Because we ought not to care how we get people there, theoretically, at least, right? We should invite every possible new model as long as we insist that we are crystal clear about the claims and we can stand behind it. And this is what employers have really loved about, I think, our program when we go to them, is that we're willing to do both of those things. And it's really very powerful stuff. Because we're facing a crisis in this country, right? It's a crisis of sustainability. It's a crisis of confidence in what we do as an industry, the product, if you'll allow me, that we produce. We face a crisis in social mobility. We have 37 to 40 million Americans, adults, today with zero to few credits, no college degree, many of them carrying debt. At a time when 70% of all new jobs require a two-year degree or its equivalent, right? We are falling behind in the percentage of our young people who have college degrees at a time when they're competing in a global economy against Indian students and Chinese students and Malaysian students and Brazilian students. You saw the most recent troubling data about the level of math and literacy in America among adults. This is troubling stuff. And you talk to employers, it's at two levels. There are the 3 million jobs everyone loves to talk about. But those 3 million jobs are at the high end. And we need to get fix that, right? So if you're a 12-year-old who can do Ruby on Rails, you get a job. You don't need a college degree. Those are those jobs. Those are technology jobs, engineering jobs. Lockheed Martin will retire more engineers in the next 5 years. I've read this somewhere, not on the internet. 5 years, then we'll graduate from our engineering program. Americans will graduate from our engineering programs. Think about what that means. So that's one kind of crisis. And, you know, if you're in a research university, if you have graduate programs, you're trying to solve that problem. I'm not working on your problem. You can work on that problem. But then you've got this huge basic skills problem on the low end. And we've got to upskill American workers, and we've got to get more people the opportunity, because it's a tougher labor world, labor market, that we all live in than it was even 10 and 15 years ago. And I think the thing, I'm going to cycle all the way back to my somewhat solipsistic showing pictures of myself as a kid. If we don't do this, so this is, by the way, this is, I love this slide, right? This is not just about adults getting, but it changes the trajectory of families. And look at this Facebook post thing. Hey, that's my mom. This is my mom. Yay, my mom. And really, there's a next generation of kids who won't have the opportunity that every woman I said, are you first generation? And we raised our hands. I don't know if this kid gets to raise his hand if we don't get on this, if we don't fix this. And that's really my message in meeting with you today. And I just I love the fact that Diana asked me to meet with you. You are the backbone, the springboard, and the platform for the kind of business model innovation that we need in our industry. And I think the problem with, if you'll permit me, and I'm being terribly presumptuous by people who know their profession better than I do, is that IT has been all about keeping the trains running on time. But IT has to be about reinventing the work we do. And if your conversation with your president is about your network security, it's not very interesting. It's really important, but it's not very interesting. But if your conversation is about, I've got the tools to empower you to rethink what we do and serve more people and do it for less money and do it in higher quality, the CIO becomes maybe the single most important person sitting at the table. Thank you very much.